to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I found more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be trapped by her. Now he's going to switch his focus a little bit from seeking to finding. Verse 27. Here is what I have found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason, which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among a thousand I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found. And this is basically what he finds. Verse 29. Truly, this only have I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. All right, so we have finding, our searching and finding. Notice first his searching. Verse 23, all this I have proved by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. Solomon is trying to find out wisdom. He's trying to find out understanding, or as he puts it in verse 25, the reason of things. Remember, we've seen throughout chapter 7 the subject of wisdom, and in particular, the difficulty of understanding how and why God acts the way he does. Why does he bring days of prosperity and days of adversity? Remember, we just saw that Solomon said that we're to rejoice in both, knowing that God is the one that determines both. Why does he make some things crooked and others straight? Remember, we saw that a previous week. And so Solomon is trying to find out why it is God acts the way he does among the sons of men in earth. So the phrase seek out and find out has to be understood as an exhaustive desire. We'll see here in a minute, it's not that he can't find out something about why and how God acts in the world, but he's trying to figure it all out. He's trying to get to the depths of God's dealings, and that's too deep. He speaks of it as exceedingly deep, verse 24, as too far off, verse 24. Who can find it out? He describes this knowledge or wisdom as too far and too deep for finite creatures like us to understand fully. We're never able, brethren, to plumb the depths, to understand in completion why it is that God does what he does. This is his dilemma. Verse 25, I applied my heart to know, to search and seek out wisdom and the reason of things. That's a reoccurring phrase, reason of things. Why it is that things are the way they are, and why is it that God acts the way he does? What is the reason for things? What is the reason of everything, and in particular, the way man acts the way he does and God acts the way he does? He tried to understand why people do the things they do, and thus he says he tried to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. Solomon doesn't here mean to say that he tried to live as wicked as he could, though he did live wickedly in this section of his time that he's lamenting. He's just saying he's trying to find out wisdom and folly. Why do people do good things and bad things? Why do people act foolishly? Why do people act the way they act, both with regards to good and bad? That's his point. And thus he uses those three terms as synonymous. Wickedness, folly, foolishness, or the wickedness of folly, even foolishness and madness. He understands that sin is foolishness. It is folly. It is madness. And thus, why does man do it? But perhaps even a more perplexing question, why do I do it? I can't figure it out. Now, he's going to get to the basic reason, ultimately, in verse 29. But at present, he's still trying to plumb the depths of God's world and God's ways in it. Verse 26, this is kind of what he found out in his pursuit. He's going to get to his ultimate conclusion again in verse 29. But in the process of looking, notice what he finds, verse 26. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. In trying to find out wisdom and folly, Solomon found out something more bitter than death. He describes here as the woman whose heart is snares and nets. Now, I take this in the first place to refer to a literal woman. A woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. I think that's a necessary understanding, especially when we get over to verse 28. But I do believe in the broadest sense, here and in the book of Proverbs, this woman that he describes repeatedly in both books, well, in the book of Proverbs repeatedly and here this one time, refers to the world as a whole, as a temptress or as a tempting thing. It refers to the temptations of this world, yes, which does have oftentimes at its very forefront immoral women, for sure, don't get me wrong. But even, and I want to turn to some of the passages of the book of Proverbs, just keep in mind that Solomon oftentimes utilizes the imagery of an immoral woman to refer to that which tempts us all, men and women. He looks deeper into the actions of this world, and what does he find? But this temptress, this tempting woman. Yes, women who tempts him, but also just the world as a whole. I think the woman, again, is put as a part for the whole. A synecdoche. Verse 26, he who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be trapped by her. Those who please God, again, are wise, and in contrast, sinners are fools. So the wise, though they're tempted by her, and can perhaps be caught by her for a time, nevertheless, because they please God and they belong to him, they're wise, they're Christian people, they fear and love God, he will liberate them from her grip so as to not condemn them everlastingly. But that is in contrast to the fool who will be caught in her trap and shall never escape her embrace. Thus, to be trapped by her means to be caught in her snares, nets, and fetters. It's, in short, to be destroyed by her. The world destroys them. Now, you know that the scripture speaks about Christians being in but not of the world, and also by faith having victory over the world. But we're still in the world. We're still living alongside fools in a world that's filled with various temptations. And thus we have to be careful. We have to watch and pray lest, Jesus said, you fall into temptations. And sometimes we do fall into temptations and sometimes we succumb to them as Christians. But this text asserts what the New Testament and the rest of the Bible make plain. While we can be caught perhaps temporarily by her, we're not going to be entrapped by her eternally. We're never going to be destroyed by her. I find more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be trapped by her. Okay, now here I'm going to pause before I come to the second part of our text, verse 27 following, and suggest briefly two observations from what we've learned. Observation number one, the ways of God are above and beyond us. We're not able, simply put, brethren, to fully comprehend the ways of God. Solomon is looking for them. He's trying to search them out, but they're too far from him. It's too deep for him. This is because God himself is above and beyond us. God himself is incomprehensible. And because God is incomprehensible, his ways are incomprehensible. Now, let me remind you very briefly about this big word, incomprehensible. God is incomprehensible in that we can never fully grasp or comprehend, hence the term incomprehensible. We can never fully grasp or comprehend his being or his ways. He's just too much above us and beyond us. Remember how he put it in Isaiah 55. My ways are not like your ways. His ways are very far from us. They're like in the heavens, and we're on the earth. As far as the stars and the sun and the moon are from the earth, so are my ways from your ways. Brethren, that's obvious, isn't it? God is God and we're not. It's like an ant trying to figure out a person. But an ant possibly can figure out a person. It's very unlikely. But the ant has a better chance at figuring out a person than we do God. Now, don't be confused here. When we speak of God's incomprehensibility, it doesn't mean that we cannot truly apprehend truth about God. God has revealed himself to us, and he has revealed something of his ways to us. So it's not to say that we cannot know anything about God. That's why the analogy really is a poor one. The ant, to be fair, isn't able to know anything about a man. We can know something about God, and we can know something about his word, because he's made that known to us in the Bible. But the point here is that we're just unable, because we're finite and we're creatures and we're fallen, and thus we only see in part and know in part. We're not able to fully grasp or comprehend who God is and what God does. And brethren, that's going to be like that for all eternity in heaven. Then we're going to see in full and know in full as much as a redeemed creature can, but we're always going to be just that, a redeemed creature. We're never going to fully comprehend God, because only God can fully comprehend God, and we're never going to become God for all eternity. We're going to be finite creatures, redeemed ants, glorified ants. Now, I want to show you this very quickly from a text in the Old and New Testaments. Go back to Job and notice verse or chapter 23. Remember, we've been seeing that Job is another poetic book that I think Solomon is dipping into throughout his book of Ecclesiastes. Job 23, look at verse 8. Look and go forward, but he is not there. And backward, but I cannot perceive him. See, Job is basically having the same dilemma as Solomon. He can't find God. He can't perceive him. That means see him or understand him. Verse 9, when he works on the left hand, I cannot behold him. When he turns to the right hand, I cannot see him. In other words, God's ways are above man's ways, and that includes Job. But he knows the way that I take. Okay, so we're not able to comprehend God or his ways, but God obviously can comprehend us and our ways. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot has held fast his steps. I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the commandment of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. Basically, Job is saying this. I just cannot find him in the sense that I cannot fully grasp him or comprehend him. But I know that he can fully grasp and comprehend me. So I'm just going to trust him and believe his word. So it goes back to what I said. We can know God, and we can understand something about God in terms of his works through his word, but that's not exhaustive. But it's sufficient, and it's increasing, and I think it's going to be increasing for all eternity. But for all eternity, we're going to just be redeemed, glorified creatures. And that's okay, because that's what we are. And God is the only being who isn't. Because everything else save God is a creature of sorts. All right? Notice how Paul put it in the New Testament. Romans 11. Now remember, he just got done in Romans 9, 10, and 11, talking about God's eternal purposes. Remember, he's talked about God's electing purposes, chapter 9. His saving purposes to the ends of the earth, chapter 10. And the certainty of those redemptive purposes in the salvation of all Israel. That is, the whole church of God. And this church is made up of Jews and Gentiles. And they're all going to be saved the same way. By faith in the crucified, resurrected, and glorified Messiah. And how does he end? Having contemplated all of this wonderful salvation. Verse 33. Oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. See, you see here that Paul is using identical language to our text, both in terms of it being too vast for us to grasp and too deep for us to plunge. We can never go that deep to understand God's ways, and we can never search far enough out to understand his ways. But did he understand something of his ways? Yes, that's why he's responding the way he does. He's responding the way he does in adoration and worship. Remember, judgments here isn't so much his judgments as we think of them upon the wicked, but his acts and his choices, his activities, which does include judgments, but his activities among the sons of men, his ways. Why does he choose this one and not that one? Why does he save this person and not that person? Why does he cause this person's lot to be filled with so many days of prosperity and the other filled with days of adversity? Why does he do that? Now, we've said many a time that there's second causes, and so we understand that. But at the end of it all, he's the first cause. So why is it that, remember what we saw not too long ago, good people die young. Why is it sometimes that wicked people die old? Why is it that sometimes righteous people are poor and always sick? Why is it sometimes that wicked people are wealthy and healthy? And again, there's second causes that answer those questions. But at the end of, at the bottom of it all, it's God's ways among men. And this is the dilemma that Solomon's having. And he's basically just telling us the same thing Job told us many, many, many centuries prior. And Paul would tell us many a century afterwards. Because the Bible is one big book with one primary author, namely God. A second observation. Life under the sun is a dangerous place. This world is a harlot who seeks to seduce us with pleasure, fame, and false doctrine. This world is one large harlot who seeks to tempt us with sinful pleasure, fame, and false doctrine. Now, I want to show you this from a couple of texts in the book of Proverbs, and then one in the Revelation. We're just going to read some passages quickly. Let's start with chapter 5. Now, I've already asserted that the woman, the adulterous woman of Proverbs, is in the first place a literal woman. But we're going to see that she's more than that, because she's put as the counterpart to wisdom, who's Jesus. So there's two competing voices in this world. There's wisdom, and then there's folly. There's Jesus and the world. And let's start with chapter 5 and verse 1. My son, pay attention to my wisdom, let your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion, and your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of an immoral woman drop honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she's bitter as wormwood. I really actually believe that Solomon is basically repeating this teaching of this text. It's almost identical. Sharp as a two-edged sword, her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path in life, her ways are unstable. You do not know them. Okay, so is this a literal woman? Yes. I would say it's the world, broadly speaking, and oftentimes, in particular, a woman of the world. Right? All right, look to chapter 7. We'll just jump in at verse 6. For at the window of my house, I looked through my lattice. He just told him, his sons, again, to be wise and careful because, verse 6, I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths a young man devoid of understanding passing along the street near her corner. And he took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And then you find this woman described, verse 10, 11, 12. She catches him and kisses him, 13. Seduces him, 14. All the way down to verse 19, verse 20. Verse 21, with her enticing speech, she calls him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare. He did not know it would cost his life. So you can see both in chapter 5 and 7, these people don't escape her. They get caught in her snares, and they don't escape. Remember, the one who pleases God, the wise, escapes her. And that's why he started, I didn't read it, but in the first 5 verses, he's exhorting his children, his sons and daughters, to be wise. Why? Because wise people are able to escape the snares of the woman. One last text, chapter 9. You know this passage, it's one of my favorite ones. You have wisdom calling out, verses 1 to 6. And then you have a foolish woman calling out, verse 13 to 18. And they're basically parallel passages. They're both calling out. The wise is calling out, come to my house. This is Jesus ultimately. This is wisdom personified. Come to my house and be made wise. I've slaughtered my meat and mixed my wine. I've prepared a gospel feast for you. This is the passage Jesus thinks about in his parables of the wedding feast. And then you have a competing voice, don't you? Whoever is, verse 16, whoever is simple, let him turn in here. As for him who lacks understanding, she says to him, stolen water is sweet, bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of hell. He's a fool, and he's not just tempted like all people are, but he succumbs to the temptations, and he never escapes her. And again, I think it's most obvious that it's not just a woman, but it's the world. And let me show you that, I think, rather clearly. Look at Revelation 17. Now, here I don't intend to give you a full exposition of the passage, other than you know that chapter 17 speaks about a harlot. We have her name, verse 5, mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. This is the mother of all whores. We can put it as plainly as that. This is the mother of those immoral women, literally. But again, this is the whore. This is the world. It's not a literal woman. She's riding on the back of a beast. Verse 3, he carried me away, that is the angel, in the spirit into the wilderness. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. This is the same beast that he spoke of earlier. It's just a figurative way to speak of the ungodly antichrist rulers of this world. There's 7 of them. That is the number of completion, 10 of strength. There's a whole lot of powerful ones, simply put. And she's riding on this beast. She's in connection with it. Verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. She is a seducing woman who seeks to lead astray the simpletons of this world. And yes, even Christians can be caught in her snares for a moment, but remember our text, he who fears God shall escape her. But that's not true of everybody. We go on. I read verse 5 already, verse 6. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. So she's not only abominable, she's filled with all blasphemy. She leads people astray into all manner of uncleanness and fornication and false doctrine. Brethren, you know that there's fundamentally a couple ways that this harlot seduces people. With sinful pleasure and false doctrine. And yeah, those two often go together, but they don't always. This is the harlot, the whore of Proverbs, ultimately. And it's the whore or harlot or woman of Ecclesiastes 7. I have a good friend. Well, he was a pastor friend in Oregon, but he retired years. I haven't heard from him for years. And then he sent me an email probably several months ago out of the blue. And I haven't heard from him for years. And he said, Mike, I've just written a commentary on the book of Revelation. Would you be willing to read it, you know, in an early copy and then write a little blurb about it, endorsing it? And I've always liked him. He's an excellent preacher. He's retired now, and he always was so clear and so concise in his preaching. And the two-volume commentary is by far the best one I own. It's absolutely excellent. And I'm not sure if it's out or if he just gave me a pre-publication copy. Two volumes, so simple. It's just like his preaching. It's amazing. His name is Max Donner. He's two volumes on the book of Revelation. Listen to what he said. This woman is the shameless source of every perversion and every abomination on the earth. Anti-Christian society. That's how he calls the heart. Anti-Christian society is the source of every kind of wickedness and actively fosters and promotes every kind of vice. The world is proud of its wickedness, boldly advertises its wickedness, actively promotes its wickedness, and it is utterly shameless in the declaration of its wickedness. This is the harlot of Revelation 17. It's the whore or the woman, the adulterous woman of Proverbs 5, 7, and 9. And it's the woman, ultimately, of Ecclesiastes 7. Let me just go back there and read the last part of verse 26, and then we'll hasten on to our second point. He who pleases God shall escape from her. Yeah, she entices us. And sometimes she gets a hold of us. But my friends, this world will never destroy us. It never will. No true Christian will either be fully overcame by her tempting pleasures or her false doctrines. But that doesn't lessen my observation, does it? Life under the sun is a dangerous place. All right, we have to move quickly now to his finding. Verse 27. Now, what he ultimately found is, again, stated in verse 29. Truly, this one thing I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Thus, we have to understand verses 27 and 8 in its light. Because 27 and 8 are less clear. 28 is very clear. Humbling clear. Verse 27, here is what I found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason, which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. He's still searching out the rationale behind all things. He's basically just repeating verse 25. He was unable to find the reason for things. Why is it that one man is overtaken by the woman and another is for a season but then escapes? Why are the things the way they are? Why does God do that which he does? Verse 28b. One man among a thousand I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found. He's basically saying, not only was he unable to find out wisdom in full, but he was unable to find very few people who could. He was unable to find anybody who could in full. I think that's what he means when he speaks there in a more figurative way. One man among a thousand I found. It's just a poetical way to say that it's a rare thing to find wisdom. And not only is it rare to find it among the men, but notice the next phrase, but a woman among all these I have not found. Now, the phrase all these suggests that he's thinking of a particular group of women. And I think it's most likely that he's here thinking about his thousand wives. And I think that's probably why he uses the term thousand with reference to the men. These were women that he married for political reasons. And if you remember, we find in 1 Kings 11 that they led his heart astray to follow and worship false gods for a time. Stop and think about it. These thousand women, we can put them all into a woman who had him in her clutches for a season. When he says, brother, stop and think. This, remember, this is autobiographical. He who pleases God shall escape from her. These women had him in their grasp. This woman, this harlot of Revelation 17, almost seduced him to his death. Remember, he's worshiping false gods. Why is it that he escapes and then writes this, basically his confessions? Well, because he pleased God. He was a Christian. He was a truly righteous, God-fearing man who fell prey for a season to the woman. So he's not here, I don't think he's being sexist. He's not saying men are smarter than women. He's not saying that. Obviously, that was a thought by many, but nevertheless, I don't believe that's what he's saying. I think he's simply speaking specifically of the women that he's surrounded by. He believed that there's righteous women. Remember what his mother told him, or what he wrote himself, or what his mother wrote to him at the end of the book of Proverbs. That there are God-fearing, wise women in the earth. Yeah, they're rare, but in this sense, so is a God-fearing man. Listen to the old commentator Charles Bridges. We cannot suppose that Solomon's judgment of woman was a universal sweeping condemnation. He had no difficulty to find female virtue in its own legitimate sphere. But here his view was evidently confined to the walls of his own harem. And among the thousand, quote, strange women, that's taken from 1 Kings 11, dwelling in that crowded place, he himself living in the open breach of God's law, in the gross violation of marriage purity, how could he expect to find the virtuous woman whom he so beautifully portrays as her price being far above rubies? All right, notice verse 29, and this is his conclusion. Truly this only I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. This only have I found. This is the chief thing that I concluded. Though I'm not able to understand everything, it's too deep, it's too vast, it's too wide, it's too far off. I'm able to get my fingertips on it. If it's like an ocean, I'm able to get at least a spoonful of it. And this is the essence of that spoonful. Though I'm not able to understand all the wickedness of man, I'm not able to understand why man acts the way he does and God acts the way he does, I am at least this. I'm able to do this. I'm able to trace all of this back, God's dealings and man's, to its origin. And thus, he gives us basically a summation of Genesis 1, chapter 2, and chapter 3. Because that's what verse 29 is. It's a summation, it's a summary of the creation of man and his subsequent fall. Stop and think about it, brethren. Solomon lives 800 years B.C. He's fully aware of creation account. He fully believes that God created a man and a woman on the sixth day. He was a creationist. And he's giving us his beautiful, humble summation or summary of that account in one verse. That's why you probably know verse 29. Out of all the verses in Ecclesiastes, most people can at least quote this one. And there's a reason, because it summarizes three chapters of Genesis. And really, more than that, it helps us to understand the world in which we live. In fact, I want to come back to that in a second. But let me quickly give you a quotation from an old Puritan, Mr. Poole. He's basically speaking on behalf of Solomon. Though I could not find out all the streams of wickedness and their infinite windings and turnings in the world, yet I have discovered the fountain of it, to wit, original sin and the corruption of nature, which is both in men and women. So he's not, again, speaking just about women. This is a family disease. It's a race disease, the human race. Notice God made man upright. The Hebrew word rendered upright literally means straight, right, or correct. It here refers to a moral uprightness and has reference to the creation of man on the sixth day of creation. Everything about man was upright. His thinking was upright. His affections were upright. His will was upright. He was upright in every way, and that in perfection. He was created, in the words of Moses, very good. Man, that's God made man upright. And secondly, man made man crooked. But they have sought out many schemes. They've become morally crooked. In the first place, this refers to the sin of our first parents, and then to all men who descend from them. So notice how he puts it. God made man upright, but they. Well, that's just using the same language of Moses back in Genesis. God made man, male and female. So he made man. We would think of that as a singular term, but it's not, because he goes on to say they. That is man, they, man. That means Adam and Eve, and it means everybody who descends from them. God made man upright, yes, in the person of Adam and Eve, but Adam and Eve having fallen, they sought out many schemes, and everyone that descends from them has sought out many schemes as well. We all have sinned in Adam, as he was our representative, and we all sin like Adam in that we go astray from the womb. And brethren, both are true. And if you deny one, you're off base bad. We've all sinned in Adam, and thus we all sin like Adam. Because it was the error, heresy, of Pelagius in the 4th century, that we're sinners only by imitation. So everybody comes out of the womb kind of like an Adam, and it just depends on his circumstances if he'll turn out good or bad. And brethren, we do believe that a person's circumstances has a large influence upon how they turn out. Don't get me wrong. But the bottom line is, I don't care if you're a Christian family or a pagan family. Your child was born sinful. So we've all sinned in Adam, and thus we all sin like Adam. We all seek out many schemes, which simply means we're born devious and deceptive. And brethren, again, that's so obvious for anybody who's ever raised a baby. I for the life of me, I can't figure it out. How can anybody actually have a baby and deny original sin? Original sin just means this. Babies are born originally sinful. Period. They come out of the womb, naughty, by nature. Now let me show it to you quickly. You know the text, Romans 5. And notice verse 12. I've asserted two things here, right? We've all sinned in Adam, and thus we sin like Adam. And let me show it to you quickly, both of them. The first takes us to 5:12 of Romans, and then we'll back up to chapter 3. Romans 5:12, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, that's Adam, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sinned. The consequences of Adam's sin was what? Death. Remember, God said, in the day that you eat of the tree, you shall die. Death was the consequence of his sin. Why does death, in all of the layers of that word, physical death, spiritual death, and eternal death, why does death come upon all of his offspring? Paul tells us, because all of his offspring sinned in him. What does that mean? He was our representative. He acted in the stead and place of his people. And somebody might say, well, that's just not fair. Why is it that Adam would act in my stead? Why is it that his actions have a direct consequence upon me? Well, if you cry foul play there, brother or sister, you have to cry foul play a little later in the chapter, where he says that Jesus also acted in our place. And we're treated righteous because of his actions. His righteousness had consequences for his people, just as Adam's actions had consequences for his. Who did Adam represent? The human race. Who did Jesus represent? The elect race. But they both had a posterity. And their personal actions had direct consequences for their posterities. And then you know, thusly, we act like him. We're sinners. Romans 3, verse 10, as it's written, there's none righteous, no, not one. There's none who understands, etc. And he's speaking about Jews and Gentiles. Everybody comes out of the womb naughty. One last text, or take us back to the Old Testament, Psalm 58. Verse 3, the wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they're born, speaking lies. You say, well, that's just talking about some people. The worst of people. Well, that's why Paul quotes texts like this one and many other ones in the Psalms in the passage that I just read for you, Romans 3. To say this isn't just talking about these wicked people that live over there on the wrong side of town. No, it's talking about your child and your grandchild. It's talking about you by nature. God made man good, man made man bad. That's Genesis 1 to 3. All right, now we have to close with two quick observations. First, this truth explains the world around us. This passage enables us to make sense of our present world. Why is our world overtaken with sin and death? Why is it filled with broken and or dangerous people? Why is it so dangerous? Why is it overrun with violence and evil? Why is it characterized by hate, oppression, abuse, misuse? Well, brethren, there's a rather simple answer to these questions, and it's a word with, yes, only three letters. I know I said love had five letters Sunday, but I think it only has four, L-O-V-E, and sin has three, S-I-N. Sin is the reason. Sin is the reason things are the way they are. In the day you eat, you shall die. Perhaps I can put it like this. We're the reason things are the way they are. Man is the cause of this dilemma. It places the blame upon man, not God. God made man and the world around him all beautiful. And man has made the world all around him wretched. Brethren, that's the simple teaching, isn't it, of verse 29. So, but somebody says, well, what about God's decrees? Well, God has decreed all things that come to pass, big, small, good, and bad. God decreed the creation of the world, the fall of the world, and the curse, for sure. But none of that makes God the author of evil. God created the world, and yes, it was a part of his sovereign purposes. His wisdom exceeds us. His ways are not our ways. It was a part of his ultimate purpose to allow sin in his creation so that he could redeem sinners and manifest his mercy and judge sinners and manifest his justice. That's Romans 9. That's why he intended all along. The rebellion of Adam and Eve and the fall of mankind, it didn't take God by surprise. It was a part of his ultimate plan. But he purposed it and or planned it in such a way that he would introduce this sin, fall, and depravity. He would introduce these things through creatures who would be held accountable. And we know the first creature is Satan, who fell first, and then he tempts our first parents, and they fall, and thus we fall in Adam, and we're culpable for that activity or action, and then we live like Adam as rebels, and we're guilty for that too. And thus we read back in Genesis 3, cursed is the ground for your sake, Adam. Adam, you've sinned, and now death has come upon your house. And upon all your posterity. Adam could have said as a good theologian, well, you know, God, didn't you decree it? Why couldn't Adam blame God? Well, he did try to blame God ultimately, didn't he? But at the end of the day, God wasn't having it. And here's why. Because he acted as a free creature. And he's accountable for his activities. Cursed is the ground for your sake, Adam. Don't blame me. You know, you have some people that say, well, I could never believe in a God who allows so much evil. Well, that's really a foolish statement, but let's just allow that for a second. I could never believe in a God who allows so much evil. Well, ma'am, can I try to help you with that statement? Why not think of it like this? God is good and he made man good. Man is bad and he made man bad. The reason why there's so much evil and wickedness and wretchedness all around you is because this world is made up of people just like you. Don't blame God. God is good. He does good. He made a good world. Man, they have sought out many schemes. God made man upright, and you, lady, have ruined it. You're the one that turned it up. In Adam, yes, and by your own wicked lives. By the way, is that your husband you're living with? No, you're not. Oh, okay. See, you're polluting the earth with your moral stench. And yet you have the audacity to say that you're not going to believe in a God who allows so much evil in the world. Lady, he allows you to breathe. You are evil. I mean, you don't have to put it just like that. But you could. and it would be true. Theologians have long, Philip Ryken, recognized Ecclesiastes 7 and 29 as an important verse for Christian doctrine, a verse that teaches us about both creation and the fall. It begins at the beginning with the way that God made us in the first place. Many people try to blame God for everything that's wrong in the world, but God isn't the one to be blamed. Charles Bridges, the origin of the evil was in Satan's heart. Man's responsibility was his consent to it, his abuse of his own free will. Not like God's unchangeably holy, but mutable, even in its highest strength of uprightness. Here, therefore, was a voluntary act, the free choice of his independent will, and therefore willful apostasy from God. Thus, man, in the exercise of his own free will, became the author of his own ruin. There's where your doctrine of free will gets you. And then lastly, observation 2. It reveals our need for a second Adam. That is, the one who was born uprightly and never once sought out any schemes. Through his perfect life and substitutionary death, Christ recovers creation from the curse and secures a land of uprightness. So God threatens Adam with death if he sins, the inference being he promised him life if he obeyed. He sinned and death came upon his posterity. Christ comes as the last Adam, the second man, conceived and born uprightly, never sins, never sought out one sinful scheme, and thus secures for his people not death eternal, but life. Thus, redemption's likened to a new and or second creation wherein man is remade or recreated upright. And so in regeneration, God recreates us. He makes us anew. And he puts one foot already, even though we have one foot in this wretched world with this whorish woman. He puts another foot in a new world wherein righteousness dwells. Because our beloved's there, and so we're already there in him. So he recreates us, he remakes us. And yes, we err all day, brethren, but he keeps us from erring in such a way that we are never recovered from the snares of this world. So it's not true of us anymore that we seek out many schemes. We sin much, but he keeps us from it. And he does so because we please him. And we please him, here's why. Because we're in Christ, in whom he's pleased. In closing, Ryken, one of the first things we need to understand is the human condition. What doctrine has greatly explanatory power than the doctrine of total depravity, which teaches that the problem with the world isn't God, but us and our sin. Depravity is the one doctrine of the Christian faith that can be proven by experience. This is as far as Ecclesiastes 7 can take us, but not as far as we need to go. If we stop with the doctrine of sin, we stop short of salvation and all will be lost. Thank God that the Bible doesn't stop with creation and the fall, but goes on to teach redemption by grace. The first Adam isn't the only Adam. There's also the last Adam, which is one of the noble titles that the Bible gives to Jesus Christ. Seeing that the first Adam failed to remain upright, we should turn to the last for our salvation. Christ is the only man who ever remained totally upright and never fell into sin. By virtues of his perfect life and atoning death, he offers to forgive us for all of our many wicked schemes. And we'll leave it at that.